the Keilahites, who they're being raided by the Philistines. It's harvest time, and as soon as the grain is being harvested and threshed, it's being stolen by the Philistines. Now, a second group of people with whom David engages are the people in the region of Ziph, which, you know, you're traveling around and going south. It's south of Hebron, south of Bethlehem. It's in the Judean Highlands. It's just about 27 miles away. Okay, so you think about your own kind of relationship to the world in which you live, 27 miles away. The people have no doubt heard what happened to the priest of Nob, which we talked about last week. And David is a person who is welcome in the midst of a crisis, but who's staying around after the crisis. His presence is not very much appreciated. Both the Keilahites and the Ziphites are ready to, and attempt, actually, to hand David over to King Saul. David saves the inhabitants of Keilah. The fortified town, though it is really a cage, because if Saul comes with his armies and encamps around the city, he basically lays siege to it, and David can't get out. So the city, realizing that that is the case, regardless of what it is that David has done for the city in rescuing them from the Philistines, they're prepared to hand David over to King Saul. Because as one person has said, it's better that one man die for the city than for the whole city to be destroyed. So that's their thinking. He travels on. He goes to Ziph, the region of Ziph. And the Ziphites, on the other hand, they're not going to let David alone. David is trying to hide out. He's trying to get away. And he's there in one of the strongholds. And he seems to be minding his own business. But what do the Ziphites do? They turn informer and betray David. They're ready to hand David over to Saul, and they call upon Saul, and Saul receives this as a blessing. And the Ziphites have no compassion on him, David says. We read that Saul is up in Gibeah, just north of the future Jerusalem in Gibeah, and it's in the hill country of Benjamin, and both the Ziphites and the Keilahites, they're both... This is important. They're both Judean cities. So Gibeah up in the north, north of what is modern-day Jerusalem, and Keilah and Ziph are both in the south. They're in Judea. So not only can David not buy a friend, he's being betrayed by his own kinsmen. And that's important. Right? These are his relatives. These are people of his own tribe who are betraying him. And you think about what must it be to be chased and run out by your own relatives. That's what David is dealing with. He finally flees to the wilderness of Maon, and it's going to come into play in chapter 25 in next week's sermon. There's a region that's even further south, and it's more desolate. It's made famous more because that's where Nabal is from, and we're going to talk about Nabal next week. But Saul keeps coming. He comes south through Hebron. He comes down to Ziph, through Carmel, to Maon, where David is keeping his distance from Saul. And the way in which he's doing it is that they're basically running in circles around a mountain. King Saul's army is kind of chasing David. David's not engaging the army. He's just staying on the other side of the mountain, and he's moving, away from Saul. And they're just circling around this mountain. David stays far enough ahead, but he doesn't turn an attack. And this has been his repeated response. He's not engaged Saul. He will not attack Saul. And it comes further into play as David descends from the Judean highlands, as I was showing you in that last map, down that eastern slope to the Dead Sea, to the oasis of En Gedi, where there's fresh water. The place today looks like a garden resort. It is a garden resort. It must have been amazing coming out of the desert and into this oasis. Saul wants David, and he finds himself unhindered. He can go after David. Now, David's information network seems to be as well informed as Saul's. And David hears of the raiding of Keilah by the Philistines. He goes to help. David escapes the setup of the people of Ziph to hand him over, and he escapes to Maon. But it's never just about David's giftedness or lack against Saul. It is actually, we read that the Lord is at work. The Lord is leading David. The Lord is delivering David. And this is how it works, right? Firstly, Saul miscalculates about the priests of Nob and about what they've left and, you know, these counselors of the Lord's tabernacle. Abiathar, who is the last of the priests, and he's the only one who survives, it seems, maybe he and his family, he has taken to David the high priest's ephod. Now, the ephod was a breastplate that was worn by the high priest, and it had gems that represented each of the 12 tribes of Israel. It wasn't merely ceremonial, but the ephod served as a means by which the oracles of the Lord were received and interpreted. Somehow there was an inquiring that took place, and a reading of what of the ephod allowed the priest to be able to discern what the Lord's will was. And so David is constantly referring to and asking Abiathar about what is the Lord's will. It's talking about he has inquired of the Lord. And the Lord is leading David. And, you know, we need to hear and be able to see that David is following the Lord. He is looking to the Lord. He is listening to the Lord's word to him to do what the Lord asks of him. And this miscalculation of Saul has cut himself off from that by killing the priest of Nob. But David has this now. Should I go to Keilah? He inquires. Yes, right, the high priest tells him. If I stay, he asks, will the Keilahites betray me? Yes, the Lord responds, right? But, you know, each case it seems like a different answer is given. Not only does David want to know and obey the word of the Lord, David is helped by the Lord, who is not dependent upon the conditions of the people that he employs. Right? David, just as he's about to be caught and overrun by Saul and his forces, by the Philistines and Saul, the Philistines come and attack, and Saul has to break off his pursuit of David. So the Lord is not merely limited to using those people who want to be used by him. He is using those people who are actually oppressing and fighting against his people. What is clear is that though his experience to us seems more remarkable than our own experiences, the Lord is for David what he can be for us. In Psalm 54, which is called, it's titled To the Choir Master with Stringed Instruments, a Maskil of David, when the Ziphites went and told Saul, is not David hiding among us? This is what David says, right? The Lord is David's Savior. You see that in verse 1. He is David's vindicator, his person of help and his upholder in verses 2 and 4. Is faithful to David in verse 4. Fights for David and puts an end to his enemies. Is David's deliverer in verse 6. In Psalm 57, right, the Lord is merciful and a refuge, is the one who shelters David in verse 1, neath his wings. The Lord works, fulfills his purpose for David, and saves David while putting to shame those who would gloat over David. Verse 3, even though David is in danger of lions, fiery beasts, wicked men who curse and mock, who threaten with spears and arrows, David looks to the exaltation of the Lord and to the Lord's victory. And what happens to those who set traps for David? They will, in a beautiful bit of poetic justice that you read about there in Psalm 57, they will find themselves caught in their own snares. You see, that's a beautiful thing that the Lord does, right? Is that His justice, it's not that bad people get bad things and good people get good things, right? Or His justice is that the wicked do actually is the cause of their undoing. They're actually ensnared by their own traps. Wouldn't that be a beautiful thing about people who are sending predatory emails and texts to try and ensnare you into taking your identity? Wouldn't it be great if their attempts to try and do so, actually they got ensnared in that own their own thing, right? Poetic justice. David, though, will not despair. David will sing. And his singing will wake the dawn. Now, what would that be like for you to experience the presence of the Lord, to experience His deliverance and His power, so that what came out of you, right, was not lament, right, but was a rejoicing that was so great right there in the darkness. That you in the darkness, right, that your singing and your joy would bring light. Right, David will sing and his singing will wake the dawn. And it is all because of the steadfast, covenant, faithful love of the Lord. David knows that the Lord is his shepherd. Now, you think about David is in the wilderness. What is that like to live in the wilderness? There are times that we talk about getting out into nature and to being out in nature that it moves us so deeply, right? It inspires us. We find that we're what I imagine is being taken out from underneath the dome of our world. And when we get outside, get out into nature, it seems like we've been freed from that. We get someplace else, and we find ourselves inspired, right? We find ourselves kind of given a new perspective from the way in which we had been thinking and had been living. These bubble worlds, right, where money and time and convenience and winning and size are of the most important things, right? That's the bubble world that we kind of live in. We get trapped into thinking that those things are the most important things. And that's the Goliath-valued world that I was talking about a couple of weeks ago. It's the Goliath world of giants. We come to the wilderness where the most striking feature is quiet and vulnerability. Right? Sometimes, right, the wilderness is a place of potentiality and possibility. But that's not all. It's not just all great, right, being out in the wilderness either, is it? The wilderness can also be a place of testing. It's not easy, right? The wilderness is made easy by conveniences. I have a friend who says, who does not like camping, and his comment on camping is that camping is pretending to be homeless. That's his experience of camping. Right, and we've actually taken camping and we've made it into something more that we call glamping. Right, the potentialities in the wilderness are just as great for danger and for death as it is with inspiration and possibility. David isn't vacationing in the wilderness. David is literally running in circles around a mountain in the wilderness. Right? It's a barren world where there are beasts and betrayers. But David is not bewildered. Why is that? Because the wilderness for David is ultimately not full of spies or informants or wild beasts or enemies or even Saul. for David and what you see in his Psalms, what the wilderness is full of is God. God meeting his need, God answering his prayers, God delivering and rescuing him. To borrow Eugene Peterson's words there, right, that the wilderness is full of God. And I wonder what the wilderness is like for you. Right? Not because you've escaped there for some R&R, but because in the wildness, such great barrenness and lack can be a place where it is that you find God. Right? The fruitfulness of the wilderness is not out there somewhere, but the fruitfulness of the wilderness is right in here. It's right in your heart. And you become a stronghold. You become an oasis like in Gedi. Now this living by faith that David does, a way in which we respond to it, the way in which we see it, the way in which we might experience it, it is something like something that awakes the dawn, a song that awakens the dawn. David flees to En Gedi, and to En Gedi comes Saul and his army. The cliffs around En Gedi, which you know I was trying to show you in that slide a little bit as you see the elevation gain, is populated by ibex who are sure-footed. That's why it's called the Wild Goat's Rocks, the place of the Wild Goat Rocks. They're confident there. I don't know if you've ever seen them move along the face of a cliff and the sorts of small outcroppings that they're able to stand on, but there they're confident and they're safe from predators. And David and his men are well hidden in a cave where it is that sheep are kept for safety. Now Saul is there, searching for David and responding to nature's call. He enters a cave to relieve himself. Did he know that he had David trapped? It seems more than luck. He's alone, King Saul is, thinks he is. He's alone, he's vulnerable, he's caught with his pants down, so to speak. Right? And David's men become the last voice of testing. Here is the day, they say, of which the Lord said to you, behold, I will give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it seemed good to you. Right? This kind of mirrors the words David defied Goliath with. But the Lord had never spoken that with reference to Saul. David has an opportunity to take. David arises, and instead of cutting Saul, he cuts off a swatch of his cloak. This cloak that David, or that King Saul has set aside while he does his business. Returning, David has passed the test. And he tells his men, the Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to put out my hand against him, seeing he is the Lord's anointed. Right? David knows that kingship is not something that he can take. He can only receive it. And he can only receive it when the Lord gives it to him. Right? The reality is so near, right, that David can almost experience it. But David, because of his faith and his trusting in the Lord, he waits on the Lord because he says, for your steadfast love is great to the heavens, your fullness to the clouds. You know, one plane that you might look at David and his life, it's as flat as it could possibly be. He's hiding out in a cave that is really a pen and full of all of the sorts of stuff that might be in a sheep pen. It's not much to write home about. He's not glamping there. But David is a giant. I mean, he's tall. He's living large on the steadfast love of the Lord. Right, it can't keep him down, this horizontal way of looking at things. What others see, what others can't see, he sees clearly, right, that the Lord's promise is true, that it is all coming. The Lord will do it. The Lord is David's safety. The Lord is David's answer. The Lord is David's refuge. Now, David wakes the dawn, so to speak. He awakens King Saul, who is the Lord's anointed, with the news of the forbearance and mercy of God. David doesn't have to take, because he's certain that the Lord's promise to him is as good as already fulfilled. And David cries out, "My Lord the King!" And when Saul looked behind him, David bowed with his face to the earth and paid homage. And David said to Saul, "Why do you listen to the words of men who say, 'Behold, David seeks your harm'? Behold, this day your eyes have seen how the Lord gave you today into my hand in the cave. And some told me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, 'I will not put my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed.' See my father, the corner of your robe, in my hand, for by the fact I cut the corner of your robe and did not kill you, you may know and see that there is no wrong or treason in my hand. I have not sinned against you, though you hunt my life to take it. May the Lord judge between you and me. May the Lord avenge me against you, but my hand shall not be against you. As the proverb of the ancient says, out of the wicked comes wickedness, but my hand shall not be against you. After whom has the king of Israel come out? After whom do you pursue? After a dead dog? That's all I am. After a flea? May the Lord therefore be judge and give sentence between me and you, and see to it and plead my cause and deliver me from your hand." What would it be like for us to leave judgment up to the Lord? What would it be like to wait on the Lord to give what it is that he has promised in his own time? Right, while we await in hope, what would it be like for us to bear that weight of waiting until the Lord glorify himself? What would we live like if we lived believing as David? Now, here's one of the things that you have to do with David and his story. We can stand aside and look at David's life. I can show you maps, and those can kind of, you can get yourself oriented mentally as to where things are. We can get the sequence of events and learn how to pronounce properly Keilah Heights. We can do all of that stuff. But what we're being invited into is to step into a story, and to look along that story to see where it is that it's pointing or heading. We would see King Saul, and we would see even David and all of what is noble about him, right? But what this is intended for us to do is to see beyond, so that we might see Jesus, who is the Lord's anointed. If this is to be fruitful for you, you have to be able to see how it is that David unfolds, or his coming and his rule and his reign in some measure is the beginning of being able to see this dawn, this sunrise that is coming, right? Because King Jesus is one who did not take but received the cup that was handed to him, right? He wandered in a wilderness, and he waited. He suffered betrayal from his kinsmen. He was handed over by those to whom he came to rescue. Right? That one has secured our vindication. He is the one whose love fills, right, from earth to sky, who fills everything with his steadfast love. Right, that will awaken us as we see who it is that Jesus is. David is merely a shadow, but he tunes our eyes so that we begin to look in the right direction so that we might see what it is that the Lord has done for us.